right. Well, first of all, hello everyone. I'm Marius. Thanks very much, Anurag, for the invitation to come here. Sorry?
All of us invited.
Thanks to everyone for inviting me. It's a real pleasure. It's my first time at Perimeter. It's a lovely place. Very cold, very inviting. So this, like you said, Anurag, this is based on a bunch of joint works regarding finite size criteria. That's the part that's missing from the title, as a method for proving spectral gaps in frustration-free quantum spin systems. Okay, and so it's those are my collaborators, and they'll show up in different places. I noticed when compiling this list that they're all from different countries, which I thought was nice. Okay, so let's jump in. I want to first define or recall what a quantum spin system is. A quantum spin system, in a nutshell, is a many-body model defined on a graph with a finite dimensional local Hilbert space. So to be a little bit more concrete, I'm going to write lambda n for a finite subset of an infinite lattice. So think of lambda n as a box in, say, Z2 of side length n. Capital N is the system size parameter. In my case, it's a linear dimension of the system. And we place a qdit, so a CD copy, Hilbert space at every site. And the equivalent you can think of is this as a spin d minus 1 over 2 particle at every site, depending on whether you think more in quantum information or condensed matter terms. Either way, the total Hilbert space is then the tensor product of the system, so it's a tensor product over all the sites in lambda n, the CD. On that system, I'm going to be considering Hamiltonians of the following form. There's a fixed local interaction, and for simplicity, I'm going to take this to be a nearest neighbor interaction. So there's a fixed matrix, little h. It's a Hermitian matrix on the space of two spins, CD tensor CD, to itself. And this is embedded onto the operators on the big Hilbert space in the usual way by acting non-trivially only on the pair I and j. Okay. So the Hamiltonian is then the sum of these local interaction terms. So at every pair of sites, I and j, which are nearest neighbors, this is what this relation means. It means two sites, I and j, are nearest neighbors in the graph. I put one of these hijs. These are all Hermitian matrices. And so the sum of them, the Hamiltonian, is also a Hermitian matrix. Now, one sort of little asterisk in that definition is that I haven't defined exactly what I mean by nearest neighbors, whether I'm allowing for periodic boundary conditions or open boundary conditions. I'm purposefully vague here because both are of interest, of course, in the applications, just some neighboring relation on my graph. Okay? So these are the kind of models I'm studying. There's some sort of simplifications here. For example, that the local interaction is the same throughout the system. In every bond, I place the same copy of H. So it's kind of locally, the system looks the same everywhere you look. Okay? Are there any questions about this?
Well, since you say that, it's also then symmetric between the two qubits and the, or qdits in the bond?
In all the...
And HIJ is going to be the same as HJI.
Right. It doesn't have to be right here. But in all the applications, I'm going to be considering that that'll be the case. There are some models of interest where that's not the case, but let me not get into it. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to talk about spectral gaps. So I want to tell you what I mean by the spectral gap in these kinds of models. So I just have some big Hermitian matrix now, Hn, and I'm going to look at its spectrum. I'm going to call the eigenvalues E0 of n, E1 of n, E2 of n, and so on. I'm going to define these with degeneracies that they're strictly ordered. These are strictly ordered. So E0 of n might be multiply degenerate. And then the spectral gap, by definition, is the lowest spectral gap of this Hamiltonian. It's the difference between the two lowest eigenvalues. Okay, that's the spectral gap for me. The lowest spectral gap is the one most relevant to condensed matter physics because it happens at low energy scales. Of course, there are lots of other gaps in the spectrum. I'm only going to consider the lowest gap. Okay. Yes?
What if you have a degenerate ground state?
Then I still define it like that.
Right, so that would be this degenerate ground state and then a gap and then something else. That counts as gap.
That counts as gap for me. That's right, yeah. So, right, that's something to point out here is that by definition, this is always a positive number for every fixed n. So it's not interesting to say that the finite size Hamiltonian for fixed n has a gap. That's always the case by definition. It's the difference between the two lowest eigenvalues. The question that is meaningful, as usual, in kind of statistical physics, is what happens as n goes to infinity, as the system size becomes large. Does this sequence of positive numbers, gamma n, go to zero, or does it stay away from zero? Okay, that's the basic dichotomy. And so I'm going to call this the gapped and the gapless case. And because it's a sequence, strictly speaking, you have to be careful whether it doesn't necessarily have a limit. So let me just distinguish sort of either the limp soup of the gamma n's is a positive number, or the limp soup is zero. So this really means it always goes to zero. This means there's a good subsequence that stays away from zero. Okay, that's the gap case. That's the gapless case. And I want to, given some big Hermitian matrix defined by these little h's, I want to decide which of the two categories it belongs to, the gapped or the gapless. Specifically, I'm interested if it belongs to the gapped category. I'm going to argue now why the gap category is of interest. Question?
Sorry, so maybe this is not intended to be fully rigorous yet, but...
it is.
But this slide, so, I mean, it's, presumably it also depends on, you need a sequence of lattices as n goes to infinity.
So just take...
sequence of graphs, right? This is.
So take boxes of side length n in ZD.
Okay, you're specializing to that case.
Well, any kind of sequence of systems that are contained in each other, right? Yeah.
So
I could also work on the
some infinite graph, and then you're taking larger and larger.
That's correct. Which is also the thing I define on the last slide. Let lambda n be a finite subset of an infinite lattice,
right, okay.
Lambda. And so for example, a box of side length n, but some other, it should be a growing sequence of subsets.
You could still have some funny behavior by adjusting where you take the lambda n's, but that's...
That's correct. Funny behavior could occur, but this is still a dichotomy, because I'm just, the limp
right.
soup is still some number,
right.
And the number is positive or not.
Right.
It's a,
you could get a different answer by taking a different sequence with the same infinite graph.
Absolutely, yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's true.
Okay.
Are we specializing to just two local Hamiltonians?
Yeah, in this talk, yeah.
Is that important?
For it makes everything more complicated too. But it's not important for the methods. In principle, you can derive methods that work more generally if you have some finite range interactions. So if that still counts as local enough for me. Are there other questions? Okay. If not, I want to explain, maybe just as a remark about this, I was just going to say, it might in particular depend on the boundary conditions you put on your system, right? Because I've just said the lambda ends are subsets of this infinite lattice, and then I have some neighboring relation on them, and so then I can maybe even make them periodic, and then that's not really a subgraph of the original lattice, but still a viable sequence of things to look at. And then the question whether it's gapped or gapless could depend on the boundary conditions. And then you could say the system is gapped with periodic boundary conditions, but not with open or stuff like that. Those statements could all very well be true depending on the kind of model you're looking at. But for me now, I'm going to look at some fixed sequence of lambda n's. Think always of boxes, ZD, and then relative to that, I define that notion. In the applications, of course, you know, it'll hopefully be more concrete and clear. Okay. So, I want to argue why I might be interested in proving specifically that a model is gapped. And here is just sort of a vague block of statements that may be familiar to some of you, but the upshot is that ground states, so the ground states that do have a gap above them, if you're the ground state of somebody, of a Hamiltonian has a gap, and those are quite well controlled. They satisfy what I would call, in summary, strong complexity bounds, especially in one dimension. They always satisfy exponential decay of correlations in arbitrary dimension, and it's proved that they have bounded entanglement entropy and approximal and polynomial time in one dimension. Certainly it's believed that they satisfy an area law in higher dimensions, but that's not proved. OK? Okay, so that's a strong notion of controlled complexity. Also, I should mention that the closing of the spectral gap, if you have a system parameter in your Hamiltonian, you vary it and the gap stays open, and closed at some point and then stays open again, that gives you one way to define the notion of a phase transition, that the ground state phase changed when the gap closed. Okay. It's related to what's called Hastings spectral flow or quasi-adiabatic evolution. That's all to say that we're happy if we have a gap. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about, so the first sentence on this slide just says if a spectral gap is so consequential, then unsurprisingly, it's going to be hard to establish in any model of interest. There are, of course, models that are gapless where it's impossible to establish because it's not true, but even the models where it should be true, it might be hard because it gives you information on the ground states. Okay. So just to sort of highlight this, here's a famous conjecture made by Haldane in 1983. It concerns the anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg chain. If you don't know what that is, that's possibly the simplest, the most natural quantum anti-ferromagnet. It's a one-dimensional model at integer spin, that should be gapped. That's the conjecture. Gapless for half-integer spin, gapped, though, for integer spin, and that's the gap part is completely open since 1983, and we have no methods to even attack it. Okay? Just to show this problem of deriving a spectral gap is difficult, so there's a natural simplifying assumption that has evolved over the years to be very helpful, and that's the frustration-free assumption. I'm going to abbreviate that by FF. So in the rest of the talk, when you see FF, that means frustration-free. The assumption has two parts to it. The first one is just kind of a without loss of generality assumption. That's that the local interaction terms are non-negative. I can always achieve that by shifting. Shift the whole Hamiltonian by a constant, shift all the local interactions by a constant, then this fixed matrix is just a non-negative matrix. The interesting part of the assumption is then that if all the local interactions are non-negative and my Hamiltonian is a sum of local interactions, then the Hamiltonian itself is non-negative operator, in the sense of being positive semi-definite, right? I'm going to remind you just what little h and hn are. Here they are. Hn is the sum of the little h's at every bond. Okay. Now, if these are all non-negative, then this is non-negative. And the question, so all the spectrum lies on the positive real axis, but the frustration-free assumption says there is a state which has eigenvalue 0. Okay. In other words, the ground state energy of frustration-free Hamiltonians is 0. So why does this help for finding the spectral gap? From one sort of overly simplistic perspective, it tells you half of the information that you need to compute the spectral gap. That's E1 minus E0. It tells you that E0 is 0. But perhaps sort of more concretely, the point is that if your Hamiltonian is frustration-free, the energy minimization problem that's implicit in finding a gap is inherently local, makes the whole problem local. Why does it do that? Well, think about, you have this Hamiltonian with the sum of local interactions, and you're trying to compute energies, you're trying to compute quadratic forms, you sandwich it with a vector psi, and then you sandwich each local interaction term, and then you sum over that to get the Hamiltonian. Now, if there's a ground state that has zero energy, that means every local interaction you're comparing with zero. There is a psi that makes all these happy, gives all these energies zero. So for any other psi that's orthogonal to ground state, you compute its energy just by adding up how much it deviates locally from the energy of the ground state. You don't have to play a game where we can try to be better than the ground state in one place, but then be worse than the ground state elsewhere. You're always going to be worse than the ground state sort of everywhere in the system because the ground state is perfect, it's unfrustrated. And so all the excitation energies of any other state come from summing the local excitation energies without possible cancellations. Local p's are all positive. So on a technical level, that's the reason why the problem is local. Okay. So we'll see that that's critical because the rest of the talk is going to be about a method for proving spectral gaps in frustration-free Hamiltonians that's called finite size criteria, where I reduce the question about the spectral gap on systems of finite size. And when you hear that, you can already think red locality is going to be crucial to having such a finite size criterion. Because a finite size criterion is going to say if the Hamiltonian is sufficiently gap-friendly on a small system, then it's gapped globally. Okay, so a quick remark. Upper bounds on spectral gaps, especially if I know the ground space obtainable from the variational principle, relatively, if you have a good guess for what the excited states look like, it's easy to make those arguments rigorous because you just plug in a trial state that's orthogonal to the ground state, you compute its energy, and that gives you a bound the gap, an upper bound the gap. But remember, we're interested in lower bounds because lower bounds on the gap, especially if they're constants, independent of system size, that's the informative thing. Okay? So we're interested in lower bounds. So I'm going to, from now on, always make the assumption that Hamiltonians are frustration-free, which means there are states in the Hilbert space that make all these little constraints happy. I think of these as, from the perspective of energy minimization, it's the constraint that you want to be in the kernel of this H. There's a state that's in the kernel of everybody. Okay. So you can also think of this whole thing as some kind of non-commutative constraint satisfaction problem. Okay, so to show that this class of frustration-free systems still contains interesting examples, I'm going to review two models. One, the Heisenberg ferromagnet in 1D, local interaction is, this is just for normalization purposes, minus SI dot SJ. So it's a negative sign, so it's ferromagnetic. They want to point in the same direction. And that model is frustration-free. It's also gapless. It has a 1 over n squared gap scaling. That's just spin wave theory. That's the discrete Laplacian, has a gap 1 over n squared. So that's a one, frustration-free model. But two is a gapless frustration-free model. I'm interested in frustration-free models because I want to prove gaps. So I'm interested in frustration-free models that are also gapped.
So this has been proven. This has been
true. Excuse me?
If I'm gapless, this has been proven.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So there's a paper by Koma Nachtegaler, for example. But I think there's probably that was known way earlier, but that's definitely a rigorous paper where that's in there. Okay. So then a famous family of models was introduced by Affleck, Kennedy, Lieb, and Tazaki in the following, abbreviated by AKLT. They were motivated by the Haldane conjecture. The Haldane conjecture involves, I told you, the Heisenberg antiferromagnet chain. That has two key features. It's an antiferromagnet, and it's isotropic. It's invariant under rotations and spin space, continuous symmetry. So they're looking for a model that has the same two features. It's antiferromagnetic and isotropic, but for which the spectral gap problem could be solved. And the reason why it could be solved for that model is that those models were frustration-free. So here's how I define an AKLT model on a general graph. On a general degree Z graph, you place a spin Z over 2 at each vertex, and the interaction is a projection that the two spins on the two vertices at that edge are fully aligned. That's an anti-ferromagnetic interaction because I'm penalizing things that are fully aligned by an energy cost of 1. And it's also invariant under rotations just because total spin is invariant under rotations. So that model is defined on any graph with a regular degree, any regular graph with the same degree everywhere. There are, of course, versions where you can kind of adapt the local spin to the local degree, but for simplicity, let's think of graphs that are regular. The simplest regular graph is Z, the 1D chain. There, you place a spin, right, the degree 2, you place a spin 1 at each vertex, and for that model, AKLT rigorously proved that that's gapped. That's a famous result. The AKLT chain is gapped in one dimension. That's a frustration-free model. Also, by the way, these AKLT models have become only more popular afterwards because their ground states are these valence bond solid states. I mean, these things are frustration-free. You can write down their ground states, these valence bond solids. And these have other names now. And in one dimension, these ground states are called matrix product states. And in two dimensions, they're called projected entangled pair states. These kind of notions really came from that paper. I think that's fair to say. These kind of constructions. I mean, of course, there are lots of other works afterwards that understood this, in particular, important work by Fannes, Nachtigall, and Werner, clarified this structure further, but a lot of the structure was already key in deriving this gap in 1D in the AKLT paper. And there's a conjecture in the AKLT paper that proved that on the hexagonal lattice, so 2D version, which is three regular, you have exponential decay of correlations. As I told you earlier, a spectral gap implies exponential decay of correlations of ground states, but not vice versa. So natural conjecture was then that that model is also gapped. The AKLT conjecture in that same paper. Okay, so those are two models. One's gapless, one's gapped in 1D, conjectured to be gapped in the hexagonal lattice, so in 2D, if you will. Both are frustration-free. Those are the kinds of models I'm interested in. Okay. So let's talk about methods. So I want to talk to you about the specific class of methods called finite size criteria, though this slide summarizes that or shows you that there are other methods for proving spectral gaps in frustration-free systems. You might say, what about non-frustration-free systems? And the short answer is we have no idea how to prove gaps in non-frustration-free systems. In frustration-free systems, there are finite size criteria. They're roughly speaking two classical kinds, one developed by Knabe in 88, and one based on a duality argument for the angle between two subspaces of Fannes, Nachtigall, and Werner. Two other methods are the Martingale method and Markov chain methods for so-called stochastic Hamiltonians, which have positive entries and a good basis, positive matrix elements. So you can use probability theory to study gaps. You can use Markov chain methods to study gaps for those. So I'm going to be focusing on what's highlighted in red here, which are finite size criteria for gaps. And I want to sort of just give you, before I talk about results you can derive from finite size criteria, I want to tell you what's the basic starting point, sort of on a technical level, of this method? What's the idea for deriving a finite size criterion? Then later on, we can talk about verifying a finite size criterion. How does one derive such a thing, and how does frustration freeness enter? So here's the basic trick, which I think was first observed by Knabe in this form. By the spectral theorem, for a frustration-free Hamiltonian, the gap bound that we're interested in proving, the gap being bigger than a constant, is equivalent to this operator inequality. H squared is bigger than CH. Okay? An operator inequality in the sense of partial order on Hermitian matrices, in the sense that the difference between these, H squared minus CH, is a positive semi-definite operator. Why are those two equivalent? Well, see, if I go into an eigenbasis here, that's saying that all the eigenvalues squared are bigger than a constant times the eigenvalue. So if I call the eigenvalues ej, this is saying that ej squared is bigger than cej, right? So for the eigenvalue 0, which is the ground space, I have a trivial statement. So it's making no statement. This operator inequality is making no statement about the ground space. But for all other eigenvalues, I can cancel one of them, and I get that ej is bigger than c. For all non-ground state, ground space eigenvalues, which is exactly the statement that the gap is bigger than c. Okay, so the spectral theorem allows you to kind of rephrase this gap bound as an operator inequality. You might say, what have we gained? Well, we've gained a lot because these are now things we can compute. We can compute the square over Hamiltonian. It's a big sum, but we can compute that square. And we can try to bound it by dropping terms in terms of the Hamiltonian itself times a constant. Let's compute the square. The Hamiltonian's a big sum of operators, but they're all, let me assume that they're all projections for simplicity. That's an assumption that in the frustration-free class you can make basically without loss of generality. For these AKLT models, everything's a projection to begin with. Anyway, let me write out this big sum as a square. Then I have diagonal terms, which since the things are projections, I just get the Hamiltonian back. And I have off-diagonal terms, and let me just label things by edges for simplicity. So I have a sum over all edges where I have off-diagonal things, and because the things don't commute, I don't have the usual binomial formula, but I have the anti-commutator between the operators. So this symbol is the anti-commutator. It just means HE, HE prime plus HE prime, HE. Okay? So let's look at this thing. Remember, we want to prove such a bound to get a gap bound. The first term is great. If the first term was the only term, we would win. The gap would be 1. So we can think of this as already having a prefactor 1 in the bank. And we want to now lower bound the rest of this big sum in terms of a constant times H such that we get something left over. That's the goal by following this method. Now, various ways to try to bound these anti-commutators, but you might say, oh, this looks really scary. There's a huge sum. All different edges are in that sum, all different pairs of edges. Well, yes, but notice that if the edges don't overlap, then these two HE and HE prime don't act on the same sites, so they commute. Now, the product of commutative operators, I can diagonalize that simultaneously. Then if they're both positive definite, then the product is also positive definite. So I can drop all of them, because I'm looking at operator inequalities. So I'm allowed to, if I wanted to, drop all this, in this big sum, all the edges that don't overlap for a lower bound, because those are non-negative, those operators on positive semi-definite. That might not be a wise thing to do. I'm just telling you the sum is not as big as it looks if you're looking at lower bounds. Okay. So it's really the key things to bound are the edges where they overlap. Those might have negative eigenvalues, and you have to understand that. And then how you do that, there are different ways to do that. Okay? But that's kind of the basic idea on a technical level. So the key thing is this rephrasing of the gap bound as an operator inequality, which uses frustration freeness in a fundamental way. So now I want to talk about finite size criteria in more depth. I want to start with sort of the historical first example of finite size criteria in this form I'm aware of. It's a 1D criterion. So what I look at is an open chain, right? So these are things that act on nearest neighbors in Z, and I sum over them. An open chain, that's my HN. And then HNPR, PR standing for periodic, I just close the chain into a ring. I let the last site interact with the first site. So HNPR is a Hamiltonian on a ring. HN is a Hamiltonian on an open chain. And I write gamma n for the gap of HN and gamma n PR for the gap of the periodic thing. Okay? Now here's a theorem that Knabe proved in 1988, shortly after and inspired by these AKLT papers and their proof. Let HN be frustration free. I always make the assumption everything's frustration free. Without it, I don't know what to do. And, I mean, in this case, Knabe. Okay? So then there are two parameters in the game, two system size parameters. Little n, which you should think of as small, think of it as like 7. And capital N, which you should think of as infinity. They play very different roles. And then here the box bound is the bound Knabe proves. So it's a lower bound in the gap of the periodic system, the large periodic system, in terms of the gap of the small system minus 1 over something like the size of the small system. That's the statement. It's a lower bound the gap of the periodic system in terms of the gap of the small system minus some, I'll call that threshold, that number. I'll explain to you why next. So that's the statement. This corollary in red is really the key way how you use it in applications. Think of little n as some fixed size. Think of little n as 7. Fix little n equals 7. You compute gamma 7, that's this chain of 7 sites. You diagonalize the Hamiltonian by hand, by a computer, whatever. If the lowest, well, it's frustration free. If the spectral gap of that matrix is bigger than 1/6, you win. What do? You apply this theorem with little n equal to 7, and n now has to be at least 14, but so what? We're interested in limiting statements anyway. So then whatever the discrepancy was between gamma 7 and 1/6, that's the constant here that we have. Remember this gap versus gapless thing? I wanted a constant C on the right. That constant is going to be gamma 7 minus 1/6. Okay, that's how the finite size criterion works. Yeah?
Can you relate the periodic to an open boundary?
You mean the other way around?
Yeah.
Presumably with the current technology one could. I'm going to talk more about boundary conditions in a second. So we'll get to similar things. I don't know the exact answer to that question off the top of my head. It's natural that it works this way because think of subsystems, right? The little gamma little n is a subsystem of the big system. If I'm on a ring and I cut out a small system, that's naturally open. It's a lot harder to think of an open chain and cut out subsystems that are periodic, right? So actually, now that I'm saying this, it makes me think it might not work. Yeah, okay, I can actually, okay. There's actually going to be a corollary on the next slide, I think, that argues why it can't quite work the same way. In general.
And gamma periodic capital N and gamma capital N, how would that be related?
Well, I mean, you can make this little n equal to capital N, or pretty much equal to capital N, right? Right. But let me go to the next slide, because boundary conditions are going to come up again in a second. So that's a good question. But that was the first one of its kind. When you see this criterion, you might want to improve it in various ways, and that's what the next slide is about. So this sort of is the beginning of a method that has been developed further in the last couple of years. So this is Knabe's bound, just for your reference. And this is just a quick corollary about boundary conditions I wanted to mention. Notice that if I know the Hamiltonian with open boundary conditions is gapped, and this tells me that the Hamiltonian with periodic boundary conditions is gapped. Why is that the case? Well, if this guy's gapped, that means gamma n along a subsequence at least stays above some constant. So I go along that subsequence until that constant is bigger than 1 over n, say little n equal to 10 million. That's where this number is positive. That's where I stop, apply this theorem, and I get a lower bound on gamma for capital N arbitrarily large. The converse is false, which makes me think why the converse inequality can't hold. There are models where edge modes can spoil a bulk gap. But what this is saying, right, if the model with an edge is gapped, then the model that's fully translation invariant has to be gapped as well. The reason why an edge can spoil a bulk gap is that the particles can use the edge to lower their energy, roughly speaking. I mean, the edge is more structure in the model, so it can have more exotic behavior. Though a caveat, you might say this bound should follow from the fact that one of the matrices was bigger than the other, but that's a dangerous argument to make for gaps, because gaps can also be tiny because you have a hugely degenerate ground space, and you add a tiny interaction term and you lift the degeneracy. Something that was supposed to be degeneracy gets lifted and spoils a gap. So gaps are a little bit subtle in this way. So there's no general statement that operator inequalities imply gap inequalities. It's only if you know something also about the kernels. Just as a sort of general caveat about this stuff. So I'm just saying these kind of inequalities don't imply by themselves gap inequalities. Okay. So seeing Knabe's bound, I think there are a few natural ways to try to extend it and improve it. First of all, it was a one-dimensional statement, so extending it to higher dimensions is a natural thing to do. Secondly, can one play with the boundary condition? Specifically, can one, this only serves to prove gaps for periodic systems, right? Can one also prove gaps in open systems that way by removing this PR, essentially? That's another question of interest, especially for open boundary conditions. And finally, this threshold here decays like 1 over n. Can one improve that scaling? That's another question of interest. And I'll talk about some results in that direction. I think I mentioned, yes, there are a bunch of results. So actually, I want to first mention that Gosset Mosgunov sort of revived this Knabe bound in 2016. And they proved already a very nice theorem, I think. They proved, they extended this result to two dimensions. And they improved the gap scaling to 1 over n squared. That's already a very nice thing. And then with Jenny Moskunov, we proved the following theorem, which I just want to highlight because I think it has a nice corollary. It's the main point of this theorem is that there's no PR on the left. It's a statement about the open gap, and this works in 1 and 2D. This is just the version in 1D, in terms of the gap of the open system. Now, you might say this minimum looks a little bit ugly, and I would agree, but the point is that the sizes over which you're computing the minimum are still comparable to little n. So it's not that bad. Now, this kind of bound, I'm only flashing this up because it has a nice corollary, and it's this corollary. You see, previously you had the gap of the open system on one side and the gap of the periodic system on the other. That you can always use in one way. You use information on the open system to get information about the periodic system, or maybe vice versa, but only from one system to the other. This kind of statement has the same gap on both sides. You can use it to prove something about the system itself. It's kind of a closed thing. So you can prove that this can't happen. Gamma n can't behave like, oh, there should be capital N here, obviously. The gap cannot go to zero too slowly. Okay, that's the statement. The gap cannot go to zero too slowly. In particular, not like 1 over n, which is of interest. Why? Suppose the gap would go to 0 like 1 over n. Then this minimum would also behave like 1 over n, right? Because it's over things comparable to n. Then this thing in parentheses would behave like constant over n minus constant over n to the 3 halves. Now for little n large enough, that number is positive. Because the 1 over n to the 3 halves term goes to 0 quicker than the 1 over n. So at some large little n, this number is positive, say n, little n equal to 10 million, that's where I stop and apply this bound. And then I have a positive lower bound on something that's supposed to go to 0, like 1 over n. So that can't happen. So these kind of bounds allow you to show that the gap cannot go to 0 too slowly. Either it goes to 0 like 1 over n to the 3 halves in this case, or it's gapped already. Okay? That's the statement. Cannot go to 0 too slowly. And that's of interest because, of course, 1 over n gap scaling, as many of you know, is the gap scaling you would expect from discretizing a conformal field theory, where you have a dispersion relation like this, so a massless dispersion relation, proportional to momentum, and then if you discretize momentum, you get 1 over n scaling from that. So that can't happen. That's the statement that these 2D frustration-free models, frustration-free is important, cannot produce this kind of CFT gap scaling. Which is apparently related to question raised by Kitaev in this Anion honeycomb paper. Okay, so the best improvement though of Fnabis method is very recent. It's due to Anurag from September 2019, so quite recent. And I think it's really great. I'm very impressed by this. So it works for frustration-free Hamiltonians on any ZD, any dimension. And the gap scaling is 1 over n squared, which is the optimal rate that we can see that from the Heisenberg model. So that's I think that's a wonderful statement. The constants you know, maybe are not so great, but it doesn't really, I think from a theoretical perspective, this is clearly the cleanest, nicest result. There's also a different proof that really relies on the detectability lemma and on Chebyshev polynomials, which I think is also great. So I think from this perspective of improving the method, this is probably the last word for now. I think this already covers a lot of bases. So from these extensions of the method, so this was all about the method itself, right? This was this kind of Knabe statement of bounds on gaps in terms from big gaps in terms of lower gaps, and there were these three ideas how we can extend them. That was on the last slide: dimension, gap scaling, gap threshold scaling, and boundary conditions. Now, another thing you can of course say when you have a finite size criterion: can you use it in any system of interest? Can you verify it? Right after I stated the criterion, I told you this corollary. If for some little n, I know that the gamma little n is big enough, then I get a gap. Can I do that in any concrete model? Right. So that's what the next results are about. Yeah.
It's a lens, right? It's not a lens to the D. It's a lens.
Very good point. So little n here is always linear dimension. Yeah. So it's linear dimension squared. Okay. Okay, so this is about applications to concrete models. So, right, what you really have to do, this is kind of all doing something like the following. Computing some gap of some finite systems for little n, some reasonable number, maybe in 1D, maybe in 2D, and comparing it with some threshold. So you're trying to prove that some spectral quantity is bigger than some threshold. And then you put it in the finite size criterion that covers the infinite system. The finite size criterion is the machine that takes you from this finite data to infinity, if you will. So that's done. All you need to do now is verify that you get some positive number. Okay? So whenever one tries to prove an inequality like this, trying to prove that one number is bigger than another number, I would say there are roughly two ways to do that. One is you have some explicit system with some explicit numbers and you compute. Say it's some system on some finite number of sites and you just exactly diagonalize it if it's very small. Or you use some other computational method to get the gap of that system. That's one way. So some exact number is bigger than some exact other number. The other way is that you have a family of models which have a parameter. And as you increase the parameter, it increases the gap. So if you make the parameter infinity, you have a huge gap, and then you try to play an analytical game of trying to reduce the size of the parameter. So as much as you can and still have a gap and still verify the criterion. So these are roughly the two ways that have been successfully implemented to verify the finite size criteria. So both have been implemented. So this now this is an overview of some concrete models, what has been done. The first one is what are called product vacua with boundary states models. These are cousins of the Heisenberg XXZ model. And there, we had a perturbative argument with Bruno Nachtergale, which works at arbitrary species number, which is a parameter in that model, which is kind of like spin, and arbitrary dimension, that's the dimension of the lattice, the ambient dimension. And so basically that was an instance of B. Okay, so these are some concrete family of models, they have a bunch of parameters, and when you make the parameters favorable, you can verify the finite size criterion, and you get gaps. So the point is, of course, this criterion is never going to give you the exact perfect range of parameters where you expect a gap, but gives you something. So the criterion is kind of a coarse method for proving gaps, but it's very effective because you can adapt the parameters to just make the finite size criterion work if you're careful. Okay, that's instance of B. And then these AKLT models are of interest. So first, there was a paper earlier this year with Abdulrahman, Lucia, Nachtergale, and Amanda Young, this original AKLT conjecture is about the hexagonal lattice, right? And so every spin is every set is a 3/2 spin. Now, what was known is that the model on the 1D chain is gapped. So one thought we had was, how do we make the 2D model look a bit more like the 1D model? Well, you take the edges of the hexagonal lattice, and you put a bunch of sites on the edges. You put little AKLT chains on the edges. Call that a decorated lattice. That's a parameter now. How many sites I decorate each edge with. That's, again, an instance of B. If I make that parameter large, my system has all these huge AKLT chains, which I know are gapped in it. Then it has a gap, and then the game is now to make the parameter as small as possible and still get an analytical proof of a gap. And that worked all the way down to 3 in that case. And then afterwards, this was picked up and extended to a lot of other decorated lattices by Pamata Vey, who are interested in this because the ground states of AKLT models on various decorated lattices are, apparently, this was new to me at the time, universal resource states for measurement-based quantum computation. These are the kind of things they were analyzing before, so they are then interested, of course, that these are gapped. It's then useful to know that these resource states are gapped. And the decoration still, you know, for many decorated lattices, that there are still such universal resource states. Okay. And then the last result, this was very recent with Sandvik and Wang. They are both computational physicists. We had some huge, 36-site system. I'm going to show it on the next slide, computed its gap. That's an exact model that you just have to compute the numbers for. You just have to crunch the numbers. And we used, intensive numerics. It's a DMRG calculation. But you get some number, and it's bigger than the threshold. And you put it in the criterion, and the criterion takes you all the way to infinity. Okay, so I'm just going to review that argument. This confirms this AKLT conjecture that this hexagonal AKLT model is gapped. It's a computer-assisted argument, though. It's not an analytical proof. And I should also mention that just 1 week after our prepend, Pumata Wei did prove the same thing by verifying a different finite size criterion with the computer. Okay, it's actually one of the finite size criteria I mentioned earlier, still based on squaring the Hamiltonian. That's still the fundamental idea, just slightly different version. It's not this exactly this Knabe type. It's actually related to the one used here in those works. Yeah?
Like for the decoration number 2, is that the standard? Is that the AKLT?
No, the decoration number 0 is the.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's really how many spin 1 sites do you add?
That's
the original, right. Yeah. So 3 is still was still kind of far away. But they I think they did all with numerics. I think they can do all of them now, right? These were analytical proofs. Okay, and analytically it stopped at 3. Okay, so on the next slide I want to talk a little bit. I just want to show you what the system is that we put in and compute the numbers for. So just to make things concrete, I don't know if this really helps for any understanding. I'm not going to make any different points from before. I'm just trying to be very concrete. Okay, so here's the finite size criterion one can prove for the hexagonal AKLT model, by which I really mean models defined on the hexagonal lattice with projectors. That's really all one's using. And then the statement is the lower bound. The statement is it's a finite size criterion. It has a parameter A in it. That's a weight parameter. I'll talk about that in a second. It's just some number. Think of A as being 1.4, that's what we choose. A is a number. It's not a system size. Sorry if this is confusing. Just the parameter, it's good to have flexibility. The point is that I have a lower bound on the gap of the AKLT model at arbitrary system size. This is the gap of a AKLT model wrapped on an n by n torus. I want to make things periodic. This is a periodic thing on the left. It's a little easier if things are periodic. Remember, there was the minimum if I had open boundary conditions on the left. That's a little annoying, so I just put everything in a periodic setting. So in regards to the very first question, this only establishes that the model with periodic boundary conditions is gap, but there's actually a paper shortly after the AKLT paper by some subset of those authors that prove that there's a unique infinite volume ground state in the sense of these C star algebras, this GNS representation, doesn't matter which boundary conditions you put. So in that sense, sort of from this very sort of algebraic infinite volume perspective, there's already only one unique ground state, and then this kind of finite size statements imply spectral gaps in that sort of algebraic setting. But that's just a remark. So I just want to be concrete here, right? So this is the gap of the periodic system at arbitrary size. So we want to lower bound that. That's what we're trying to do. This is a finite size criterion that it doesn't depend on capital N anymore. It depends on this parameter A in a bunch of ways. But the point is, this is the gap of some finite subsystem where A enters in it minus some threshold. Depends on A. Let me define for you the subsystem. So it's, if you count, there are 36 sites in here. All the edges that are drawn in have an AKLT projection on it. So every site is a spin 3/2, right? So C4. That's the Hilbert space, it's a 36-fold tensor product over C4. And at every edge, there is a projection on to total spin 3. This has open boundary conditions, so these edges are really dangling. Right, so there's a spin 3/2 here, but it has only one edge. And then the edges that are dashed and have an A, there the projections are not just projections, the interactions are not just projections, they're projections multiplied by A. It's just a weighted projection. It doesn't have eigenvalues 0 and 1, it has eigenvalues 0 and A. Okay? It turns out this weight is important. It's just a way of refining the method, which actually goes back to this Gosset-Moskunov paper. Okay. So I call gamma f of A the gap of this system with parameter A. Okay. And now, right, now one puts this on a computer, and DMRG, you know, after a bunch of convergence tests and so on, says that the gap of the system at parameter value 1.4 is bigger than that number. And you compute the threshold at that number, this fraction when A is 1.4, is less than that. So I have nothing more intelligent to say than that number is bigger than that number. And so the finite size criterion applies, and this gives a lower bound on the gap at arbitrary system size, which if you put the numbers in, you get 0.006, which, by the way, it's believed that the correct size is about 0.1. So this is still off by a good bit, factor 20, I guess, but still. It's a bound. I mean, it's a uniform bound on the system side. That's what we set out to do, right? So the point is that I forgot capital N here. Well, I guess, okay, I wrote, that was not, there's a typo here. It's not very clean. The point is that I get a lower bound on the system with periodic boundary conditions for arbitrary size of the torus that I'm wrapping it on. That's a gap in the thermodynamic limit. It's in this gap class that I defined in the beginning, okay? So this was just to be very concrete. Was the AKLT model, that's the kind of finite subsystem one uses with these weights, puts that on a computer, computes the gap of that, and then that number that one gets is bigger than that number. And you know, since I'm a mathematician, I should be very clear that we do not claim to have rigorous bounds on the numerical error. I mean, I wouldn't call this a mathematical proof. It's a computation, but we trust the computer, of course.
But the DMRG also gives you a ground state, right? Or excited state. So you could just, it's a witness, you could just use that to.
Yeah, but that's an upper bound. Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I just don't claim that this is a rigorous mathematical, right? There's no, we don't control the numerical errors. That's all. Okay.
But if I chose a different value of A, it's possible that this gap might show.
So right, so this criterion is always funny, right? It's a sufficient, not a necessary condition that number gamma f of A is bigger than that number. So when the number is not bigger than the threshold, then it tells you exactly nothing. that says the gap is bigger than some negative number, which you already know it's a positive number. So it's really the question, can you find a good A such that gamma f of A is bigger than the threshold? There are lots of other A's for which it's not. Right. Are there other questions? So then Pomata Wei did a different finite size criterion, also used intensive numerics and verified the same result, get a different lower bound in the gap, but the point is that it's a system size independent. So that's about these applications. So remind me, should I talk for a whole hour? Should I leave some time for questions? What's the usual way?
Maybe like 5 minutes for questions if you want. How long do you think?
I can stop in 5 minutes. This is after this. There's just one summary slide.
Sounds good. Yeah. So please go ahead.
Yeah, I can just skip to the summary slide. Okay. The main message I want to convey is that the existence of a spectral gap above the ground state for these quantum spin systems has far-reaching consequences. It's something we care about because it tells us a lot about the ground states themselves. In particular, first and foremost, exponential decay of correlations. Otherwise, sort of other notions of finite complexity. Finite size criteria are a method for deriving spectral gaps. They only work for frustration-free models. That's important. And there's a reason why that is the case, because only in this frustration-free class are the excitation energies sums of local excitation energies with no possible cancellations. So you can understand the problem locally by cutting it up. Therefore, finite size criteria have a chance of being applicable. They're always just a sufficient criterion. They don't really capture the whole subtlety because they're always just some finite fixed system. But they can be very, very effective, especially if you have one of the two situations. Either you have a good weighted criterion and you have a strong computer, or you have a parameter to play with. In those situations, they can be very effective. Some open problems. The AKLT model on the square lattice, still unknown if that's gapped. That's still a matter of speculation and conjecture. Even in the physics community, I would say the reason is, of course, that you put the system on this AKLT system on a small subset of the square lattice, and you compute the gap of that, and you get tiny numbers. And so you don't know, it's hard to extrapolate to infinity if things are really tiny already from the beginning. And people do believe it's gapped, and there are arguments that suggest exponential decay of correlations, which is a strong indicator being gapped, but it's not proved that it's gapped, and that's a natural next model to attack. Something I kind of skipped is would have been on the last slide. Let me just very briefly say, for any sort of difficult problem, like deriving spectral gaps, it's sometimes nice to introduce some wiggle room, which you can get from a probabilistic perspective. You can start talking about random Hamiltonians, and then one can analyze the typical gaps of random Hamiltonians. And that's just in the beginning, and there's just one paper about the 1D case, and I think that's an interesting direction to pursue further, to sort of take a probabilistic perspective and sort of talk about typical cases. Or at least cases that occur with positive probability. That's the first thing you can study. Another thing that I think would be interesting to explore further, this is particularly vague for now, if the local interaction terms commute, then everything has gap one. So then it's not an interesting question. It's really the non-commutativity, and I think that should be related to entanglement of the vectors spanning the local interaction, the ranges of the local interaction terms. That's also not very explored. There are, in this case of the random Hamiltonians, there are some indications of that. And I think finite size criteria can help to understand how things come from local entanglement, because they make everything local to begin with. And finally, in all lists of open problems about spectral gaps, the Haldane conjecture should be mentioned. And I should always remind everyone that if things are not frustration-free, we know very little, and we don't even have methods. So that's what keeps me up at night, and that's all I wanted to say. Thanks for listening.
Any questions?
So, I mean, I guess I would classify things a bit differently than you did at the beginning, where you have, there are cases where the limit is defined as n goes to infinity, and those could be either gapless or gapped. And then there's cases where the limit is not defined, whereas you just went with the lim su.
Yeah, right.
And that class where it's not, the limit is not defined is also pretty interesting because it indicates that something weird is going on in the thermodynamic limit. Do these methods give you kind of any insight into when that happens?
Not really. I would actually first of all argue that typically the only thing you need is a good subsequence, because in the end you're studying the infinite volume thing. So you're allowed to skip things that are bad. So I think actually the lim sup is the correct definition. If you're interested in a thermodynamic formalism, so these GNS representations, then you get a gap of the infinite volume guy if you have a good subsequence.
Well, no, I mean, because I mean, the real physical world is not an infinite volume thing. It's just some very large number, right?
Fair enough.
And if the limit is not defined, and you can, and the lim sup is different than the lim inf, then that means that there's some kind of fine sensitivity to exactly how big the system is, which seems to me to be an indication that actually the thermodynamic limit in the physics case
mm-hmm.
is not well defined.
Well, that, I mean, that's a question of what do you call the thermodynamic limit, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is that,
right.
Is that in the cases where the limit is well defined, it's kind of unambiguous what you mean by the thermodynamic limit.
Right, right.
And in cases where it's not well defined,
yeah,
then you have to get into these fine details about exactly what that means.
So I should say, in all the applications I discussed, so let's stay with concrete models. So in all the applications I discussed, it was a very simply defined family of growing subsets, either was the n by n torus in the hexagonal lattice, or they were just boxes in ZD that were growing. In all cases, the gap bounds that we derived just work for any sufficiently large system size parameter, and from then on to infinity. So we don't see any of the subtle cases there. I don't, off the top of my head, know of any subtle cases. I recognize that that is a possibility, and I don't think the methods will say anything about them.
Okay. I mean, I could probably construct some. So these translationally invariant computationally hard problems are an example where you get
these undecidability stuff.
Well, the undecidability is an extreme case.
Right.
Yeah, even just where it's computationally hard, which is a related construction.
Yeah, okay.
That's a case where kind of the energy levels fluctuate a lot. I mean, we don't actually have a gap case where it's hard. Probably the cases where it's undecidable might give you an example where actually the limit is not defined.
That's true, I think, yeah. Well, one thing to say about this is that it's always just a sufficient criterion, right? So it's never going to capture the full subtleties. Right.
Sure.
So it's only really useful as a tool to prove gapped if you're lucky in that sense. So I don't think it has anything to say on that. That's not to say that those are not interesting questions.
Any more questions? Oh yeah, there you go. Hey, go ahead.
Okay. Oh, so your methods work with lim sup or lim inf. So I think this inequality is that for any n bigger than something, it's always bigger than
correct.
N. So it's like lim inf.
You're right. So there are two things I want to distinguish, right? One was the definition of what it means to be gapped that I had in the beginning, sort of in some abstract. And we had some discussion if that's the right definition or not. And there I used lim sup, because I sort of had the thermodynamic formalism in terms of this GNS representations in mind. But you're totally right that in all the applications I discussed, we indeed proved something about a lim inf. So in those applications, that's a shorter way of answering the earlier question. In all the applications, the subtleties don't appear. And that's exactly right. We prove a statement about the lim inf being a positive number. Yes.
I have a comment for the previous discussion. I think for Haskell, when the size is L to n minus 1, there is no graph degeneracy, so it's gapped. But for others, then it is gapped. It's gapless. So maybe
okay.
No.
That one is in his sense, it's gapped always because its degeneracy is changing by
zero.
No, because he defined it as just the distinct energy values. So that, which then hot code is just the degeneracy is changing in a weird way, which is also interesting, but not in quite the same way.
I was wondering if you could tell us more about generic gaps.
Right. Well, actually, I can say something about generic gaps, but I can only make this statement. That's the previous slide that I skipped. So thanks for the question. Whilst this is motivated by, many of you know probably Ramis Mobasag, he gave a talk. The paper is called Generic Hamiltonians Are Gapless. The model is constructed by taking these local interaction terms in any dimension to be random matrices. IID random matrices, say GUE, GOE, Hermitian, of course. And then looking at the spectral gap of the resulting local Hamiltonian, where all the terms are totally independently picked at random. Okay? So that model is actually gapless with probability one in any dimension. And the reason why that happens is if you have this system which has all these IID copies, then there's a kind of rare local regions argument where sort of anything that can happen will happen, and there are these small subsystems that effectively almost decouple from the big system, and then it's basically tensoring with something, and then you get all these tiny degeneracies. That's roughly the argument. I don't know if that was clear, but anyway, the proof is fundamentally using this IID. So this motivated asking the question about the same question, essentially, about the translation invariant class. So it turns out there, one can only do something in 1D. And one can not prove something with probability 1, so that's not a genericity statement. It's rather the statement is a little bit different. The statement is that they are gapped with positive probability. So the convert, that statement is false. It's not that they're not gapless with probability 1, right? The IID case, they're gapless with probability 1. In 1D translation invariant, they're gapped with positive probability. It's exactly not that. And so how does one construct them? I should be a little bit more specific. What I mean by 1D random translation invariant models, because they also have to be constructed in a specific way. So I take the H, we're going to construct a 1D Hamiltonian. I take the H to be a random local projection of fixed rank. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, for example, I could take a Haar random unitary and look at the first R columns of that. Those are orthonormal vectors, and I can take the span on those. I'm just giving you an algorithm for picking R. R is a number, it's gonna be the rank of the projection, orthonormal vectors. Or in other words, a random rank R projection. I think that's one natural algorithm, but you can think of other ones. The point is I take one fixed guy at random, one fixed local interaction, and then I put the same everywhere. Hence creating a translation invariant system. I'm not taking all the local interactions at random all the time, like previously. I'm taking one at random fixed and then putting the same everywhere. That's what I mean by a random translation invariant Hamiltonian. Okay? And then the statement is that if the rank is small enough, then this is gapped with positive probability. Okay? I think that's just a starting point of analyzing these things. But it's a first statement that already shows that the translation invariant class is distinctly different from the gapless, from the non-translation invariant class, it's IID class. Okay, and I think there are lots of other questions to ask here, but the point here is I have to fix the rank to be small, then I sample a random projection of that fixed rank, and then with positive probability one gets a gap. And the proof is by a pretty simple finite size criterion. And I should mention that for qubits, for d equal to 2, this follows from previous work of Pravi Gosset. The argument extends to trees, but it really, this kind of almost one-dimensional structure like you have in Z or in trees is important for this argument. The reason is that Hamiltonians of small rank, you might say there's no frustration-free appearing in this theorem. The reason is that if you have small rank, they're automatically frustration-free because it's basically a counting argument. Right, it's sort of some kind of rank nullity theorem. You always have somebody in the kernel still. And you do that inductively. That's for induction, that's good if you're on trees or on Z. That's the key thing. The key thing is how to get frustration freeness. Otherwise, it's maybe less interesting to say that if I condition on being frustration free and have positive probability. No, the point is that these are automatically frustration free. Which is not, that's not my result, that's the previous result, but by Mubarak et al. So that's
lowest level hemolysis.
Yeah, so there's, right, it's an induction on, right. So that's a long answer to perhaps a short question, but it just led me straight into this.
Awesome. I guess we can keep the rest of the questions offline. Thanks to my guest for a very, very nice talk.